Welcome to StartupRad.io, your podcast and YouTube blog covering the German startup scene with news, interviews, and live events.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Joe from StartupRad.io, your startup podcast and YouTube blog from Germany. I'm right now here, as you can see, if you're watching this on YouTube, in my a little bit cramped study, and I do have, of course, a guest again for you. Today, I do welcome Peril here in my podcast. Hey, welcome. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing, Joe, today?
I'm doing great. Thank you. I've been stalking you a little bit on LinkedIn, as I do with all of my guests. Everybody who'd like to reach out to you directly, you can go down here in the show notes. There'll be a link to your LinkedIn profile. That said, you are living a very interesting life, I would say. Is it possible that this is true? So I can say you have been in India, in the US, and you're based right now in Germany. How did this happen?
Well, as you can see, I am an Indian. So I was born and brought up there. I educated there, and I also worked there. And my work actually gave me opportunities to travel the world. So I happened to travel all across the world wherever I could go with my job. And I ended up living in Germany because it's closer to US and closer to India, and it's pretty central on the globe. And Germans really welcomed me. So yeah, I decided to be here in Cologne.
Cologne. It's also interesting because if you are from India, if you're thinking about, yeah, let's do the two time zones, India and the US, it's more frequently that you're actually thinking about, for example, the UK, especially London. Why did you settle on Germany and especially Cologne here? And after you've answered that, we'll poke a little bit around your CV.
Yeah. So it's a funny question and a very interesting story. So you'll hear a lot of stories from me, Jorn, if you go back in my life. So what happened that time was, it was turn of century. I used to work for Ericsson HP, and I, like I mentioned, I used to travel a lot. And interestingly, my husband was in a job which also meant a lot of traveling. And through his job, he got a mandate that he was supposed to set up an office here in Europe from his company. That time he was working for Dell Aerosystems. And it was mainland Europe, not in UK, in London. They already had an office there. So he was looking to set it up in Germany, somewhere in Germany, Switzerland, Austria, DACH region pretty much. And because my I had some connections here, and because as a family, when we decided to move here in Europe, so I got an option to work here as a functional head in German telco that time. And we ended up in Cologne. So that's pretty much it.
I see. For everybody who's not from Germany or German speaking, we may add that DACH region actually means D for Deutschland, Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. So it's basically the German speaking area. And Liechtenstein is so small, we don't even take the acronym in there. That said, you, what did you actually do before you became an entrepreneur? We heard you've been working with well-known companies at the time. How long did you work there, and what happened that you became an entrepreneur?
So I, like I mentioned, so I pretty much mentioned Ericsson, HP, German Telecom. And so that my corporate experience was about, I guess, about 10 years plus, 10, 11 years. And then I became a mother. So as young parents, my husband had actually set up his business, and we decided as a family to move back to India after the birth of our child. And because we were having these kind of traveling jobs and with a small kid, and we decided to be together as a family and not travel around. So I quit my job and we both decided to move back to India. And at that time, where we have a house in Delhi, so all the companies had moved outside of the main Delhi. So either I would be traveling in direction of east or west of Delhi. 2 hours per day. And being in the middle management meant I would be traveling domestically as well internationally. So I decided, what the heck, I'm going to go my own. I converted the basement of my house, one-third as the office and two-thirds as a play area, hired another nanny, which was easier and affordable to do in Delhi, and called my network and I said, well, guys, I'm going my own. And it was a telco-based startup, so to speak, in today's days and time terminology. So that's how my startup journey as an entrepreneur started in the summer of 2007.
I see. And you obviously skipped the part where you worked for a cable provider. The service for the German cable providers is not as bad as in the US, but I do believe Germany is catching up there. Been at that point back in 2007, you've been a mother, you've been in Delhi, and you started being an entrepreneur. Okay, and now we have just to make the tiny switch from a basement in Delhi to Cologne. How did that happen?
So like I said, so it was starting, happened in 2007, and the business was growing, and I obviously expanded from my basement over a couple of times. So that means I did something right there. And then I was traveling. What a surprise, after a few years, when you have a business and you have international customers, you have to travel. And the travel grew over a period of time. And then it was a time when the child had to go to school. And again, a family business combination in decision making. And we decided to move back to Germany because my husband's business was in automotive and aerospace, in which I had invested in. And my business was predominantly around telco and IT services, with customers expanding right from Europe to Asia to US. Again, knowing Cologne as a city, and we always had ties here. We always kind of came back every summer here to meet our friends. So yeah, it was an obvious choice if we are moving out. So we'll kind of move back to Cologne, and ended up moving here in 2011, end of 2011.
We may add that I've been also living in Cologne for project something like approximately a year. Admittedly, Cologne has some very nice looking places and some very bad looking places. A friend of mine who's living there for decades now, he says Cologne is more a feeling of living than actually a beautiful city. Would you agree to that?
I guess so. If you compare certain parts of Dusseldorf and Bonn, so yes, we do have ugly spots. But yes, it is definitely the energy in the city. You know, when we first came here, we moved from Delhi, right? So Delhi is a big city. Wasn't as populated 20 years ago as it is now, but it was still a big city and still populated. And compared to Bonn, where we first went, we found that as a sleepy town. And at the age where we were in, we decided to move to Cologne, which seemed more familiar and livelier. Of course, Dusseldorf was still rebuilding at that time.
We may add, for everybody who's not too familiar with German history, Bonn used to be the capital of Germany. It is actually so small that it was sometimes called the capital town of Germany. I know what you're saying there, but it's obviously also a very beautiful city at the River Rhine. So now we are with a little stop in Bonn, we ended up in Cologne. What did you do there?
So like I mentioned, so I got a job at German Telecom. So German Telecom was going through deregulation process at that time, which you rightly pointed earlier on, briefly mentioned upon. And then I became the functional head for one of the cable assets here, which was Kabel NRW that time, which got rebranded to Ich NRW GmbH, then rebranded to Unity. And now what a life has come full circle. It has been sold to the competitor, Vodafone. So that's how it all happened.
Admittedly, we tend to bash a little bit the cable companies here, but this recording is also done via Vodafone. They're not sponsoring this podcast, but if anybody from Vodafone is listening to this podcast, you know how to reach me, right?
Yeah, I like the color of your jersey. It's kind of going in that direction too.
Well, I'm actually wearing it because it's like a little bit fall color. And right now, when you look outside, we're recording this on October 6th. So outside, it's getting a little bit darker, a little bit more rainy. But I actually like that. It's the best time of the year for peppermint tea. Yes. Okay, and then from being a functional head of a cable company, which at one point ended up being owned by Vodafone, when did you take the step to be like an entrepreneur again?
So like I said, so I was the head of IT. That was way back when I joined, and I quit in 2007. And I went on my journey from 2007 onwards as an entrepreneur. And on the journey, built many businesses, not only in telcos, but then also in education technologies and mobile gaming and stuff like that. Before I exited out of the businesses, and from 2015 onwards, I was predominantly investing in startups as angel, business angel. And that goes for both me and my husband. We both were doing that. And at some point in time, doing these investments and analyzing different use cases as we were receiving these investment cases, we realized they were like, there is a problem in industry in general in venture capital and risk investments. And we decided to turn that concept into reality. And we are very passionate about it. And that's when we launched DoDash earlier this year. And that is a problem of information asymmetry is what we want to solve as part of our venture with DoDash Capital Networks.
We may tell our audience here that I've been one of the first few hundred members of DoDash because you guys sought me out and I joined. And you can also be a member of my group at DoDash where you can actually help, for example, to formulate questions for startups or help me select startups there. It's not a free group. It's a paid for group, but nonetheless, you will find the link down here in the show notes. That said, because you're actually not only an investment platform, it has characteristics of a social network as well, right?
Yeah, so as our go-to-market, you're right, Yon. So we basically flipped our go-to-market strategy. We have first launched a community network, especially in the COVID times when we had to launch, and our product is still under build at the moment. And we are looking at Q1 next year where we'll be launching the first version of our product in the market. So community is more like getting people together and also helping the early stage founders who are predominantly looking for education and network. And as they kind of go through their idea validation, they're looking for product build and other ecosystem players help. So pitching help and other things like financial documents and stuff like that. So we have a huge network now. We launched early May. We have more than 1,800 people. We're close to 1,900 actually now on the platform, growing on its own predominantly through recommendation. And we are present across 81 countries by now. And of course, there are verticals right from, you can take right from financial services or healthcare or augmented reality, tourism, gaming, education technology. So there are different verticals which are represented on the platform, even aerospace. Agri-tech is also there. So there are a lot of people who are there on the platform. It's pretty vibrant. And we have really early stage startups to startups which are at late seed series A. And we also have investors there who are angels to really large funds. So it's represented across by variety of people, even in a small numbers that we have in the community. It's very, very focused and very, very startup oriented.
I see. When I've been going through the network, actually, you have some very specific hubs where you have groups for certain cities, right?
Yeah. So it's very interesting you touch upon that. So after we launched, we didn't even think about it. Like a lot of people reached out to us and they said we want to also launch this community in our own cities. And we said, okay, let's think about it. Let's do it in a proper way. So we as a team We are four founders, and we basically came together and we brainstormed, and we came up with the concept of city leaders, as we call them, ambassadors. They are our ambassadors, Dudash ambassadors in individual cities. And with COVID at that time, we call them as sparring ring leaders. And we are present across 16 cities right now. We we have a 4-week masterclass program, which we basically help them to have a structure around the whole thing. And it's progressing pretty well. It's going pretty well. So far, we have a really good representation with these people across. We are very thankful to them.
Sounds good. Where is currently like your biggest city groups? Where is your kind of hotspot right now?
Yeah, so there are like lots of hotspots. So of course, India being one of the very populated country. So the quite a few cities are represented within India. Then we are also present in Middle East, and which is Dubai, Abu Dhabi, this region, and in Saudi Arabia as well. We have a chapter there as well, and growing quite steadily in South Africa, Cape Town. And we are also present in Israel, actually. So I was very happy when the, this Abrahamic Accord was signed up. So we were present both in Dubai and Tel Aviv. So it was really great to hear that the cooperation can take place even in a much larger context now, in a much better way.
I see. Let's get a little bit back to how this came about, because you and your husband have been investing in startups and there was an issue. Can you kind of take us on your train of thought? What was like the way leading up to starting Dudash, and especially the moment when you thought, let's do it that way? How did this happen? How did you actually, because that is something you don't think about. You get up one morning, oh, I'll launch an investment network for early stage startups. That's not what usually happens, right? So basically, what was your train of thought? How did this story build up?
Yeah, every success story has like 10 years of midnight oil burning. So we have about 2 years plus now, not 10 years. So the way it happened was like I mentioned, we've been investing in startups for a while now. And we've been analyzing the business cases and the propositions as they were coming along our way. So we invest directly, and also we are LPs with one of the funds based in US, and we receive different types of information whenever we are investing in any startup. And every startup has their own journey, their own definition of a problem, solution, business model, or how they want to solve a specific problem, their approach to the whole thing. So there was no way to kind of have a standardized method, so to speak, to analyze the market. And there is a lot of research that needs to be done to analyze the investment opportunity. I would say personally, I learned a lot because I got to know about shoe businesses. I got to know about different markets, which I never thought about could potentially grow and happen. So these are some side benefits other than just purely investing and talking about the benefits of risk capital in the long term. Then we thought of creating, let's say, a checklist or standardizing the process between just me and my husband, right? Our family office is just we both, right, where we invest. And how can we streamline this? And this is where we were. And we were talking to other friends who are also angel investors, and how do they go about it? And they came up with their own set of problems. And then because we also invest through a fund, and we ask them, how do you go about it? So, you know, it was like one thing led to another, and then it became like a challenge that we should solve this challenge. And we ended up talking to a lot of founders and a lot of investors and a lot of funds. And we realized, oh, my God, this is genuinely a problem which needs to be addressed. And as part of our giving back, we were also running an accelerator program here locally to, you know, invigorate the startup community here in Cologne for the last few years. So with that effect, we launched Founder Institute here in Cologne, and we kind of funded it through the first part. So it successfully two programs have been concluded. And there again, right from idea stage to some startups who have raised some funding, we found there is a lot of information asymmetry that is there. And there is inconsistency and incoherence in information that either founder shares. And it's not necessarily they're doing it on purpose. They just don't know which information needs to be provided at what time, what should be the frequency, and how that information should be updated. Or even if I have to, let's say, prepare a financial plan, is there a template for that? There is no template for that. If there is a startup which needs to be valued, there is a valuation that should be done. So how I value a startup versus how you will value, perhaps it could be different valuation. And also the parameters and the dynamics of a particular industry or a particular market could be different. So there are a lot of variables and a lot of data points that need to go into it. And my background is predominantly data. And so that's where I see there is a lot of data that can be collected, and we can try to solve this problem by connecting the dots and creating certain models, data models and knowledge graphs, and creating some kind of, you know, encoders going forward with which we can solve this problem. And inherently, a lot of decisions that investors do are also biased in some form or the other. And you must have, you know, you can validate that. You're pretty much, you know, aware of this in the industry. We know that most of the investments go to men, and they also say it's white men, and female founders get very few investments. The founders of color get very, very little investments. So through this process, we should be able to remove that cognitive bias in the long run. That is also a intrinsic motivation that we have, that the investment should reach to the people who really deserve it. Make this process efficient, make this process transparent. And with COVID, we have seen that fundraising can happen over Zoom or Skype calls. So hopefully that can just accelerate going forward.
You actually make me smile when you've been talking about the story of Dudesh, because usually a startup, an entrepreneur starts with one problem, but apparently you had a whole list of problems, which was quite interesting for me. Since you're one of the, also an investor I have now in the interview, and we're talking about investment readiness of startups, is there like a rule of thumb how much information a startup should provide? Because when I see a lot of pitch decks, when I help them to figure out what they're doing, where they find investors, that's usually a problem for startups. Either they don't provide a lot of information, or they provide way too much information, so the important bits and pieces get covered somewhere in all the ocean of information. What is your like rule of thumb, your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think a whole, you know, when you're having a conversation, and if you and I meet for the first time, and it could be either ways, right? Either I'm a founder, you are an investor, or the other way around. A holistic pitch deck, which has like 10 to 12 slides, which has a problem solution definition, competitive landscape, what would be your go-to-market approach, your business model, who your team is, all of that, you know, if you can have all those ingredients, which basically shows that your basic research and your basic thesis is in place. And then if you have started building your product, if you can, you know, holistically give an update about that. Even if it is just, you know, an MVP or idea stage, you can talk about how this product will look like, or at what stage you are in. And I think the most important slide or most important information for any investor is traction. So traction for a very early stage startup, idea stage startup, is always market validation. How many interviews you have done, how much, you know, how much feedback do you have from the market? Is there a demand for that? And if you have an MVP, have you tested that? What is the uptake of that? Is your pricing working out? And then once you launch the product, then how you're going to, you know, going in that iterative loop and keep building that product. So I think those are it's not something that nobody knows, but it's just the process. And I think this process and keeping all these moving parts together for a founder is always very difficult. And I really have a lot of respect for the founders who are able to put it all together and holistically update that. And I would say this is really the baseline for me to look into any startup evaluation, and how good a founder, how nicely he or she is able to communicate their journey, their process, how honest they are about their journey. I think that is very, very important.
What I found most memorable right now from this interview is investment is a process. So it's not a one-time event. It's a process, and it starts way before the investment and it continues way after the investment, is just my personal experience. And that is something that the Dudash Network then takes up.
Yes, that's right. So I think that's a very valid point. So the idea is that you provide your information in a structured way, which is accessible to the investors. As founders, you can control what information you are providing to which investor. So you can decide when you want to open, how your conversations are going on. And once you update them, the notifications are provided to the investors, and then they can get in touch with you. You can get in touch with them. And as you release the information, that trust, that transparency should continue to develop that trust to bring you closer to the investment. And the investors should feel more confident in investing in a particular startup when they see the journey of a startup founder, which is more transparent. And that kind of leads to the investment decision. And if the startup founder continues to update, even if investment happens, that only builds trust and subsequent rounds for a startup as well as investor. That's all I can say. And with Dudash, of course, the investability platform will enable the entire digital communication in this process.
I see. So I would assume only thing left for me to say is, for all entrepreneurs who are interested in that, you can go down here in the show notes. There is an option to sign up for Dudash as well as joining our Dudash group of StartupRate.io. No more words needed. Everything said.
Looks like that. People are signing up.
Great. It was just a pleasure having you here. Thank you very much. And hopefully we'll meet again pretty soon.
Absolutely, Jan. I'm really happy to have this discussion with you. And with our community, we basically like to extend also some benefits and perks to the startup community, which we will extend to your community as well. So we have a typical HubSpot for entrepreneurs, HubSpot for startups who've done some fundraising, or Freshworks for early stage founders or late stage, depending upon what stage they are. So the credits are decided based on that. And of course, we've also partnered with AWS. So, and there are more coming. So these are three notable big partners that we have, and we'll be happy to extend that to your community as well.
There's no more I have to say about it. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Have a great day.
That's all, folks. Find more news, streams, events, and interviews at www.startuprad.io. Remember, sharing is caring.